On this episode of Skeptico.
Now, it's entirely possible the UFO phenomenon has something to do with extraterrestrials, but not in the materialistic way that's always pushed. So that materialistic model isn't just with science, but it's also in so many people studying the paranormal that they just, everything has to be nuts and bolts, and the facts do not support that nuts and bolts scenario. We can't understand these things for what they are, because our brains are limited. And even though mind may not equal brain, the brain is what we have to use to interpret our reality. And a lot of this stuff may just be beyond the capability of our brain to actually faithfully interpret.
Yeah, no, I agree. I mean, if you've got a 12-inch black and white tube television, you're not going to be able to see some of the detail in a film that was released, you know, last year. I think the way to really excel is to sort of just beat them at their own game. And I think that if we can keep on, you know, knocking at the door of what consciousness really is, it isn't the end game, because I think it's going to open up a lot more stuff after that. But like, if we can just undermine that one thing, it really does make everything fall down like a house of cards.
Stay with us for Skeptico.
Welcome to Skeptico, where we explore controversial science and spirituality with leading researchers, thinkers, and their critics. I'm your host, Alex Sakaris, and today, the first of a new type of show that I'd like to do, and I think I'd like to do more of these, it's a roundtable discussion. So today I have two folks who I think have done a really nice job with roundtables, and since I've listened to their show and enjoyed their roundtable discussions, I decided to have them on for my inaugural roundtable discussion. And those two guys being Soraya Azkath, creator and host of WhereDidTheRoadGo.com, and Joshua Cutchin, author and frequent co-host along with Soraya on the show. So it was super fun talking to these guys. I think we got into some really interesting areas that are probably familiar for a lot of skeptical listeners, but then you have a different perspective on it, so that's new, isn't it? Anyway, there's not much of a need for a longer introduction. Let's get right to the roundtable discussion. As those of you listening probably know by now, I am a fan of podcasting as well as being a podcaster. And when I find a show I really like, I like to pass it along. And that's certainly the case with WhereDidTheRoadGo.com, a show that explores all manner of different paranormal phenomena and weirdness that we're a part of in a very sharp, insightful, and unique way. And that's largely due to the show's creator and host, Soraya, who joins us today. Soraya, welcome to Skeptico.
Well, thank you, Alex.
It's great to have you on. You know, we met a little bit over a year ago. You were nice enough to have me on to talk about my book. And since then, mm-hmm. I've followed your show, and I'm just really just excited to make it a part of my regular kind of routine of listening to things. And I love where you've gone with it.
Well, thank you. And have you been on once or twice? For some reason, I feel like you've been on twice.
Maybe I was on before the book. So that's
good. Yeah, because I was a fan of Skeptico, and I think I just asked you to come on and talk about stuff.
Ah, that's great. That's, you sure did, which is really nice. And thanks for remembering that. And let's also introduce the other person we have with us today, because joining us is another guy who is partially responsible for some of the cool stuff and some of the ways you've taken the show, Soraya, Joshua Cutchin, a guy who really burst onto the scene in 2015 with his acclaimed book, A Trojan Feast, The Food and Drink Offerings of Aliens, Fairies, and Sasquatch. And like I said, just was acclaimed by everyone in this field for exploring these unexplored connections between food and food offerings and various kinds of paranormal accounts. And then Josh followed it up just this last year with a book, The Brimstone Deceit, an in-depth examination of supernatural scents, otherworldly odors, and monstrous
miasmas. Yeah.
Miasmas. I knew that word, and then I knew I was going to forget how to say it. So Joshua, great to have you on. Thanks so much for joining me.
Oh, I appreciate all the kind words. I am still the boy wonder to Soraya's Dark Knight, but I'm still glad to be here too. I've been a longtime follower of Skeptico and of your work, and I still distinctly remember sitting backstage at a concert reading Why Science Is Wrong and getting strange looks. So yeah, I've been a longtime follower of you and your work, and I never really thought that I'd be here, so I'm very excited.
Oh, wow, that's so nice of you to say. It really, really is. Because I think, you know, we can have this kind of mutual admiration society, but it's true. You guys are really doing some cool stuff. And as we were just chatting about a minute ago, one of the things that you do that is particularly interesting in the way that you do it are these kind of in-depth roundtable discussions that are more than just a bunch of guys yakking it up on Skype, but really kind of dive into things at a level that you can't get to with an initial interview. And because we've covered a lot of the same material and some of the same books and authors, I'm hoping we can kind of get there today. And I'm copying a page out of the Where Did You Road Go playbook here and seeing if we can kind of recreate that little bit of that magic with a roundtable discussion.
Sure.
And Soraya, tell folks a little bit about your background as well and how you came to do the show, a little bit more about maybe what the show is about and where you see it going. And I've heard you mention that you also have a book in the background that you can't quite get out there yet, but tell us that, because you have shared on the show some really, really, really interesting stories about your background as well and your experiences.
Yeah, well, my background, I mean, I was always interested in paranormal stuff when I was a kid, but I was also interested in, you know, Godzilla and Star Wars and things like that. It was all, you know, it was that level of interest. It was like, oh, this is cool. This is neat. About the time I hit a teenager, I started experiencing morbid Kundalini arousal. So that tipped my worldview all over the place. I had no idea what was happening to me. Doctors couldn't help me. I was just in agonizing pain and had all kinds of weird problems. And it wasn't till
so real quickly, you know, that is a pretty strange, but in the Indian tradition, well documented kind of thing. Tell folks what that means, how it manifested in you, and how you knew. What did you know it was a Kundalini awakening at the time?
No.
Also, I'm not familiar with the term morbid Kundalini.
So Kundalini yoga is where you get the normal Kundalini awakening, where you go through the process of slowly awakening this energy that's supposed to be at the base of your spine and move up through your chakras. Morbid Kundalini awakening is when it just happens and you don't know what's going on. So I had no idea. I mean, this was not the term Kundalini. We're talking early 80s. The term Kundalini was not something that was just thrown around. Now you hear about Kundalini yoga, but it's still not a super common term. And when it woke up in me, initially it was like little hallucinations. And I knew they were hallucinations because they were things that, like, I'd be playing trombone and I would see steam coming out of the end of it. And I knew there couldn't be steam coming out of the end of it, but for the life of me, I watched it happen. And I'm going, what is happening to me? Why am I going crazy? You know, and all this other stuff. Eventually, it started manifesting with pain in the chakras. I didn't know what chakras were. That was one of the things that really struck me when I started learning about this stuff, is that it conformed to the chakra system. That, you know, this was something other people had experienced, and it made perfect sense years later when I finally found out what it was that had been essentially attacking me for all those years.
So this went on for a long period of time, huh? For years?
It still happens. I mean, I still have it. It never stops, but at least now I know how to handle it.
What I find interesting about that, Soraya, and I always have, is that unlike most people who have their first experience with the paranormal, and they can always, most of them can always chalk it up to, you know, some sort of, I was seeing things, or I was, you know, I was a little bit on edge, and I, you know, I imagined something. But if there's pain involved, it's pretty clear whether or not it's in your head. And I think that's part of the reason that you sort of wound up on this, you know, path that you were on, is that was something you couldn't deny.
Oh yeah. And the only pain I experienced worse than that is when my tooth abscessed. That's the only thing that was worse than some of the Kundalini pain. I actually blacked out once standing up from the pain.
Wow.
Once I learned what it was, I started grabbing books from the library left and right, trying to learn how to control it and what to do with it, and learned breathing exercises. So when it started to hurt, I'd be able to kind of work with it. And I've met other people who have it too. And it, with certain people, you can really connect in with it. I mean, there was a there are times where I can pick up information from people's chakras. It's a very strange sort of thing. It's like a rush of information and visions when they're having a Kundalini attack.
I didn't know that about your background, but that kind of fills in some holes, I guess, or some gaps in how you've approached some of these topics on Where Did the Road Go? Has it? I mean, you do a different orientation. And then, Josh, I want you to jump in, too, because you both have, you know, a bit of a different take on some of these topics than than a lot of people do. I'll just leave it at that.
Well, with me, I mean, once I realized what this was, there was a lot of verification there. Like I said, the chakras and this stuff and that stuff, and the fact that I had been examined by so many doctors who said there's absolutely nothing wrong with you. It's an energy thing. I can't deny that there's energy. I can spread it to other people. And if it was in my head, I wouldn't be able to spread it to other people. You know, I mean, that's just it makes me look at everything kind of energy based to some degree. And even though, like, when I started looking more into UFOs, you know, initially it was Bud Hopkins and stuff. And I was like, oh, yeah, you know, this is what's going on. But I very quickly spread out from there and was like, no, that doesn't make sense. And at some point I realized some of my experiences matched some of Whitley Strieber's experiences. And I went, but there are no UFOs in mine. But this is the same archetype. And so, again, to me, everything comes down now to some level of energy and the way we perceive things.
Yeah, I would agree with that by and large, although I do think that there, in what I've seen, that there is some sort of other that, you know, interfaces with humanity from time to time. But one thing that I kind of came into this with no dog in a fight. I was actually hyper skeptical of stuff like alien abduction, and I still am in a material sense. I really came into it, and the more I started looking at folklore and the more I started looking at a lot of these trends between these different phenomena, the more it has become clear to me that there's some sort of linking material here. There's something that ties all these things together. And I'm slowly, I mean, I slowly came around, and Skeptico played a good role in this as well. But I slowly came around to the fact that consciousness has something to do with all these phenomena. Now, it makes me sad because there are some fields that I'm interested in that will never go down that road. I've said a long time, I don't think cryptozoology will probably ever go down the consciousness route. They're still going to try to, you know, rationalize things like dog men and Nessie and everything as, you know, unidentified animals or relics of some sort of bygone era. But if you look at stuff like, you know, fairy folklore, alien abduction, even, believe it or not, a lot of Sasquatch stuff, it all does seem to have a sort of shared consciousness angle that I don't think, if you're being intellectually honest, you can really get away from.
Yeah, that's a tough one, I think, for me, because when I hear the consciousness thing, I mean, that's where I started. I started on this kind of really straightforward kind of, you know, I have more of a business background. I was just kind of straightforward. Okay, go talk to the people who know. They'll know the answers. You'll talk to the scientists. You'll get the answers. And then, you know, that'll be it. And so that was my approach with consciousness. Okay, what's the story? And what I discovered is that I discovered two things. One is that there's a lot of gaming of the system. There's a lot of misinformation. There's a lot of misdirect. There's a lot of what has become, you know, described as the trickster kind of thing going on. There's all of that going on, but there's also just a lot of protecting of turf, you know? So yep. One of the questions I had, or topics I wanted to throw out, is how do we get past this, you know, very materialistic scientism that still dominates the worldview that most people have, you know? And even if they accept it, because people have this strange dichotomy going on where they're kind of managing two different ideas. Overwhelmingly, they think science is good and science is true. You know, the idea that science is wrong about everything just throws people, oh, what are you talking about? My iPhone works perfectly fine. But at the same time, you know this, you know, when you talk to people about UFOs, Yes, overwhelmingly. When you talk to them about spirit communication, you know, depending on how you phrase it, but when you get down to it, overwhelmingly people think there's a reality to that. So, you know, the average person has no problem managing those two, what appear to be contradictions to the kind of real science types. They have no problem managing those two. And yet when we try and wrestle this stuff to the ground in our podcasts or in talking to all these experts, I kind of feel like we have to jump on one side or the other. You know, on one hand, you don't want to sound like a condescending smartass that says, you know, you're full of crap, man. I mean, you're peddling this materialistic stuff that just doesn't make sense. And there's all this strange phenomena out there that we can't explain. And on the other hand, you want to lean on science and you want to say, you know, Joshua, your book relies on careful analysis, relies on that kind of sciencey, kind of serious look at things. How do we balance those two?
Well, for me, like I said, coming from the Kundalini thing, I know that this energy exists. It cannot be explained by a purely materialistic model. There's nothing there for it. And having that personal experience verified, to me, I don't really care what the experts say. I talk to people all the time who just, you know, they'll find out I do Where the Road Go, and they'll kind of start telling me about stuff that's happened to them. And I don't think to them science matters. You know, I think it is that, oh, look, I got a new iPod. Cool. Science did this. But they don't care if the scientists come out and say, well, there's no such thing as this or there's no such thing as that. They kind of just take it with a grain of salt and keep going on. And I think eventually you're going to see that materialistic paradigm just kind of rot away.
I think the way to really sort of excel in this game of shifting the worldview of folks is to sort of just beat them at their own game. And I know it feels like that's been tried and it's been, you know, sort of battered down and pushed to the margins, but it hasn't been tried for that long. I think we just got to keep on hammering it away. I mean, I think that you allow a generation or two to die, and a lot of this is going to be a lot more accepted. I mean, even since I've been following paranormal supernatural stuff, a lot of that facade is already beginning to crumble. I mean, it's sort of tilting in that direction. And I think that if we can keep on, you know, knocking at the door of what consciousness really is, that is, it isn't the end game, because I think it's going to open up a lot more stuff after that. But like, if we can just undermine that one thing, it really does make everything fall down like a house of cards. Just undermine this mind equals brain hypothesis that's out there. If that can be tossed to the side, then it really opens up all these things that we're talking about.
The other thing is, when you bring up, say, UFOs to people, they automatically think extraterrestrial, because that's what they've been thought to think. I mean, that's all you see in the mainstream media. If it's pro UFO, it's pro extraterrestrial. Now, it's entirely possible the UFO phenomenon has something to do with extraterrestrials, but not in the materialistic way that's always pushed. And anytime I stop someone and say, well, what if there's this? And if you look at this, it suggests this. They become a lot more interested, and they're willing to kind of go away from that. They're kind of like, oh, that is really interesting. And so that materialistic model isn't just with science, but it's also in so many people studying the paranormal that everything has to be nuts and bolts. And the facts do not support that nuts and bolts scenario.
Yeah, but the facts don't support a pure consciousness model either. That's one of the things that kind of, I think, sometimes irks me, especially since I've spent so much time trying to wrestle these materialistic nitwits to the ground on consciousness. And then when I jump over and hear, you know, people in the UFO community or the paranormal community just sprinkle consciousness all over the place. Like, consciousness, consciousness, consciousness. Like, we know what the hell consciousness is. That's exactly the point. That's what we're pushing against with the scientism folks, is we don't understand consciousness. We don't know when it begins, when it ends, what's necessary and sufficient. So therefore, we cannot start making a bunch of assumptions about it. So,
correct.
It's like we're playing this game that we want to play. I want to play the consensus reality game with you guys. I want to play it in my daily life. And that is that, you know what? We're talking on this through this computer on Skype. We're really doing it. This is really happening. But at another level, we could say, you know, it's nothing's happening. You know, it's all a simulation, or it's all created in our mind. My perception is different than your perception at the very deepest consciousness level. I can only be sure that I'm consciously aware. You could get into all those philosophical things, and you could also get into, there's some science stuff too there in terms of quantum stuff and all the rest of that. But my point is just that it's tough to play both these games, because we do want to play the consensus reality game, which is what science is saying. We can measure things. We can put together a survey and say 80% of the people saw this and this and this. But we have to be careful there, because we know that there's this other dimension to it that we're totally leaving out of the equation when we do that. I mean, whether it's your energy fields that you're talking about in Kundalini, or whether it's spirits and what role they're playing, you know. So how are we trying to carve up this reality in a way that we're then can put it into this little box that we can feel comfortable in talking about it? Do you know what I mean?
Yes, yes. And I think the problem is, as you said, the pure consciousness model doesn't quite work because there are measurable things. Now, in the end, there may be no separation between consciousness. We may be drops in the same pool. Or we could all be very unique things that are, you know, connected to one thing underneath. I mean, there's no way for us to see it for what it is, because we're inside of it. And there's no way to get outside of it and then relay information back, unless possibly that's what's happening in near-death experiences, which obviously you know quite a bit about.
Let's pin that down, because we're talking maybe too abstract for folks. You know, both of you guys are not super keen on the ET phenomenon, extraterrestrial, they're aliens in these spaceships that come down. Let me play skeptical here for a minute. Doesn't Stan Friedman have a point in that we have a lot of observations that, if we're going to play the consensus reality game, a lot of observations that fit into that category? Multiple witnesses on the ground see it. Some people physically touch it. It's picked up on radar. It's maybe picked up on some kind of, you know, photography in some way. Mm-hmm. All those things add up together on one sighting, then don't we have to say, simplest explanation is ET, alien spacecraft?
Yeah, but guys like Stan, I mean, you know, admire him though I do, have gone on record saying, you know, it's highly likely that these extraterrestrials that he's positing have harnessed the ability for telepathy. And if you let that through the door, then everything is on or off the table, depending on how you look at it. I mean, I think that personally for me, I mean, yes, consciousness has become sort of a buzzword in paranormal circles, sort of akin to quantum. It's used to throw around to explain things when we don't have an explanation. But at the same time, if psi effects can have an effect in the material world, a measurable material effect, I don't see why consciousness-based phenomena couldn't be used to explain some of these other Magonian events, like UFO sightings.
So what's wrong with Stan saying they've harnessed telepathy?
Well, I mean, no, there's nothing wrong with it. But to say that and then to feel as though you have to adhere to the longstanding narrative that there are little scientists coming down in nuts and bolts spacecraft is to me a bit beyond the pale, because if telepathy
could project anything they want.
Yeah, I mean, they could be, you know, they could be higher selves that are you know, showing witnesses these things. They could be sitting on a planet, you know, a million light years away and projecting this into our minds. Because if you let that one unscientific, in terms of the materialist consensus, if you let that one scientific data point in, then there's no reason that you have to adhere to this idea that there are, you know, spaceships that require, you know, dilithium crystals to float down to the surface. You know, it seems to me like if you are acknowledging the presence of consciousness in these phenomena, and you at the same time are dogmatic to any one particular view of these phenomena, especially from a materialist standpoint, then you're sort of living a dual existence in the study of these fields.
I kind of get the no man's land you're talking about there, but let me pursue this a little bit further and be the Stan Friedman supporter here, because we all have respect for him, and I have a ton of respect for him, and I think that, you know, people like that who blazed this trail so long ago, we will never really be able to fully acknowledge, you know, what they went through, because they did pave the way. But all that aside, I mean, here's a guy who also, you know, I think he wrote the book on Betty and Barney Hill, and I think he's extremely open in that account, and I've had him on the show, to just reporting the consciousness aspect of it there. So I don't know what you would ask him to do there, Joshua. I mean, he's saying both. He's saying, okay, over here, it looks like a nuts and bolts craft. And over here, there's these consciousness kind of things. And we can't just say consciousness, because we don't really know what that means. But these extended realms that they seem to be playing in that are also seem to link up with what our government has tried to play in with MKUltra and mind control, and they're trying to get in the same place, and that maybe the aliens have kind of gotten there first because they're erasing people's memories and they're talking to people and planting ideas and doing all that stuff. I mean, I don't know how we both seem to be true as far as I can tell. What's the problem?
Yeah, so I didn't necessarily intend for this to turn into the beat up Stan Friedman hour, because the guy has sacrificed, you know, years of his life to this in a way that I will never be able to. I guess what it would come down to me is I don't think Stan Friedman has ever cracked open a grimoire in his life. I guess that's sort of where I would come down to it. I feel like, from what I can tell, in his interviews, that this other possible interpretation hasn't ever really seriously been entertained by him. You contrast that with someone like Jacques Vallée, who, from what I hear, is very well read in better read in esoteric occult literature. Yes, thank you, Soraya. So that would be my criticism. And if he, you know, if to the contrary to that, if he has really sort of sunken his teeth into that aspect or that possibility as an explanation of these phenomena, then you know what? More power to him if that's the conclusion that he's reached. But I have the sense that has always been sort of held at arm's length with him. I'd love to talk to him about it sometime.
So my thing with this type of stuff is that we see something and we apply attributes to it that aren't necessarily the case. So, for instance, a lot of UFOs, more often than not, they don't shoot off into space or across the sky. They just blink out. Many UFOs go underwater. So you have the whole USO phenomena. But yet we attach space to it, no matter what it is. And it's kind of like you see a light in the sky and you go, well, that doesn't look like a plane. It must be a spaceship. You see the same light in a house and you go, oh my God, it's a ghost. You know, we attach these labels without having anything to really fall back on to explain what it is that we're seeing. And I suspect part of what happens is that our brain doesn't know what to do with some of this stuff. When I had Ken Gerhardt on, his stuff was a great example. He did a whole book on flying humanoids, and a lot of them were one or two off encounters. And, you know, he was really puzzled by this because he's a very flesh and blood cryptozoologist. And I said, well, what if we're encountering energy? And our brain has no idea what to make of that energy. So we come in and we see something, our brain goes, monster. And it just kind of paints something in that place because it doesn't know. It scares it. It's a complete unknown. It just throws something in its place. It relays to us, there's this big winged creature with horns running at you. Get out of here. And then you go and honestly report it because that's what you saw. Now, what may have actually been there is a form of energy that we had no idea how to interpret. And when you get multiple people, it might kind of spread in that sense, or the object itself takes its form off of what we project onto it.
You know what? I could stay there and we could have a great conversation about that. But maybe we hit that just enough that let me throw another similar topic out there, because I think it's going to push you guys in the same way. And it's an interesting discussion. It's one of the things I really wanted to talk to you about. Ancient aliens. So mm-hmm. Let's throw ancient aliens. I feel like, you know, you guys rail against the ancient alien kind of explanation of things. I get that on one, in one sense, in the same way that you were just talking about, Sarai, you know, somebody going, oh, look, it's a man from outer space, you know, kind of thing. And that's the end of the conversation rather than the opening salvo. So what's wrong with the ancient alien hypothesis?
I don't know that there's anything wrong with it. It was something I was really interested in early on. And I just, you know, when you look at the data, you find, you know, people like Eric von Däniken, as good a work as he did bringing some of this stuff to light, also kind of intentionally misrepresented some stuff to make it fit his theory more. And when you look at some of the stuff, you can understand that this stuff isn't extraterrestrial, or it's not proof of extraterrestrial presences. It's entirely possible there are ancient aliens in our past. I don't throw away the idea that they could have had something to do genetically modifying us in some way. But when we look at, for instance, a cave painting that looks like it has grays on it, and you realize that, as Graham Hancock has done a lot of work on, you get these beings also in altered states, and there's lots of other things in those cave paintings that indicate altered states. I think instead of looking at the ancient alien roots, we have to look at the altered states of consciousness root when we're looking at stuff like that. And a lot of this stuff can be explained away. There's very few things, I think, that sit out there that say the only explanation for this is ancient aliens.
Well, and again, a lot of the people who have sort of been adopters of the ancient alien hypothesis have a tendency or, you know, a disposition, an affinity to view a lot of anomalous historical artifacts, so just a lot of anomalous history in general through that particular lens. And I think that gets a bit grating as well.
Yes. Yeah. And, you know, like the TV show, I enjoy the TV show at times, but you know damn well they're stuck because they'll be like, well, we want to do a show on this because it's interesting, but somehow we have to work aliens into it.
You know, you recently had an interview, Soraya, with Artie Sixkiller Clark.
Uh-huh.
On Star People. And I interviewed her a couple years back with one of her earlier books. Excellent interview, by the way. I have to commend you because I could tell, you know, here was somebody who wasn't totally in your camp, if you will, exactly, you know, lining up, but you really allowed her to tell her story and not just tell her story. I mean, you just did a great interview. So I commend you for that. But what do you make of that, right? So here's someone who's saying, you know, oh, you want some cross-cultural confirmation that this is what's going on. Here it is, Native Americans, Star People. It's in our ancient myths. It's in our current recorded events of a lot of these people.
One of the things I found interesting is that many of these people would say, oh, you know, I had an encounter with these Star People, but they're not the Star People of our ancestors.
But some of them said they were the Star People of our ancestors.
Yeah, but more said they weren't, I think, than did. But the thing is, again, we're looking at these stories, and I believe these stories are genuine. I mean, if a couple that snuck in there maybe weren't, okay, it doesn't change the overall picture. I think these people have real experiences, and they're viewing it in the context of their worldview. You know, because we don't know how to put this into our worldview, so we have to do something to kind of fit the pieces together. And I've always been fascinated by the whole ancient alien Star People Native American myth, because I want to know what's behind that and the ant people who protected them from the end of the world. And, you know, to me, there's something there, but there's not enough information for us to really figure out what it is or what really happened yet.
Yeah, but like I say, I mean, how do you respond to the, again, cross-cultural confirmation? You know, it's there. That's the kind of stuff that points us in that direction. Josh, jump in here, because I mean, this is some of the stuff that it starts getting in a way at some of the stuff you've looked at in your books as well.
I mean, yeah. So to me, well, two things. First of all, you know, Artie is someone who, even though I think that people like Soraya might not, jive with her particular interpretation, her research is top notch, and her ethnography is just is fantastic. But
absolutely.
I think if you look at a term like star people and you have these interactions where they say that they come from, you know, the stars or something like that, it's still framed through It's still framed through a lot of culture that has been talking about UFOs in terms of spacecraft from other planets. It's still framed within our understanding, our basic materialist understanding. When in reality, there's so many different ways that that can be interpreted, to my mind at least. I mean, I think that if you look at the role that stars play in cultures, that's a sort of whole different, Gordon White sort of kettle of fish. But I think that it's still sort of filtered through a perception that we've been indoctrinated in terms of. Now, I find in terms of like cross-cultural confirmation, I find those stories a lot more interesting the farther back you go, because there's less of this, spaceman mythos that we've constructed in this current day and age, and more of a spirit-based belief structure. And when you have people saying very sci-fi type things in that belief structure, that actually is more compelling to me than people saying, sci-fi sort of aliens coming from space things in our modern day setting.
There are two things that shook me loose of the extraterrestrial thing. And I'd like to say it was Jacques Vallée, but it wasn't, because when I read the first Jacques Vallée book I read was Dimensions. And to me, what he was saying is that all these ancient encounters were actually aliens. And of course, that's not what he was saying, but that was what I took from it. The two things that shook it off to me, one was reading Transformation by Strieber and realizing that in some of my magical and occult practices, I had encountered the same things. And suddenly I went, okay, I don't feel like I'm dealing with extraterrestrials, but it's the same thing. It's just under a different mask. And the other thing was reading Kenneth Ring's work, where he compared, people who had near-death experiences and people who had alien abductions and showed all these similarities. And it just stopped me and it made me think, why would these two things be similar? If extraterrestrials are taking people and dealing with them in a nuts and bolts reality, why are they having the same after effects as people who have near-death experiences? And I didn't know what to do with that. And it took me a while to finally just kind of deal with the idea that these things probably are not what they seem.
Well, I don't think any of us know what to do with that. And but I mean that seriously. But I think it's really, really cool to get to that point. And that's what I think you guys are kind of celebrating in what you do is getting to the edge of that mystery and saying, damn it, these things do not fit together. And, and I'm doing the same thing. So I'm just kind of pounding on the same. I'm at the same point exactly with you. I'm just pounding on it in a slightly different way. And I'll, right. I'll continue to pound on it because, Josh, you seem to be going one way, and then I felt like you kind of switched to the other, So, like Jeff Kripal and Strieber, and they both wrote that book, and it's a fantastic book, And that was their thesis, was one of them was, hey, we are bound by our science fiction. Kind of whatever we imagine, that becomes the limits of what we can become, and we need better science fiction. One of the things that I found so interesting about Artie Sixkiller Clark is I think her body of work kind of pokes some holes in that. Unless you think that, everyone on the reservation is sitting around watching 1950 sci-fi movies, which we generally think that's not the case. That's why we look to them, because we say, gee, there is a culture that is really kind of different, but similar enough, where we know there's some bleed over. But if it exactly matches our culture, we say, hey, wait a minute, that now the mass media explanation kind of is weakened a little bit by that.
Okay, the last book from Artie, however, did not deal with people on the reservation, but people who were living in urban centers who were Native Americans.
Still, I mean, but to me, that makes it even more interesting, because now you have, so you have all these people, right? You have these people, Native American, living in reservations. Yep, she has not just Native Americans, but indigenous people of other cultures. And bam, it all starts lining up the same. We have these ancient myths, star people, and as you say, those aren't the only myths, but that's the predominant theme that runs through it. And you have the different level of media, modern media absorption, if you will, in their culture. So again, you get what I'm saying. That's kind of control for it. Does weaken the Kripal sci-fi, and I have tons of respect for Jeff Kripal. I think he's fantastic. But I think it weakens that thesis a bit.
I still feel like we're chasing after this thing of trying to slap anomalistic phenomena with a materialist or completely non-materialist label. And I think that the truth of the matter is going to be someplace in between. It's like what we were saying earlier. I mean, you have physical evidence from a lot of these phenomena that is, entirely measurable and, entirely presentable, entirely documentable. But there is this other consciousness-based component. What I would tend to disagree with a lot of mainstream ufology with is the role that consciousness plays in these things. I think that mainstream ufology, if there even is such a thing in this day and age, which is a topic for another conversation, but I think that they're just willing to grant the whole consciousness thing this tiny toehold of, these flesh and blood aliens are telepathic and that's it. The rest is, these spacecraft. I think where I disagree is the percentage of how that breaks down in terms of what is an objective component and what is, this sort of perceptual consciousness-based component. I mean, for example, a hypothesis that I would be very open to is the idea that perhaps there are spacefaring plasma charges. And whenever they come here, then we graft onto that particular vision, our cultural interpretation. In, not necessarily a sci-fi interpretation, but in the case of some of this, Native American lore, a lot of the star people myths that they have. A lot of people would say, well, you're just saying it's all in your mind. But no, this is more along the lines of this co-creation sort of hypothesis that Greg Bishop has been talking about for a while, is that, sometimes we might be seeing something and sort of grafting onto it a way for us to understand it. Now, whatever that means, it could mean if we're, if we're mired in sci-fi, it could mean that perhaps the phenomena itself has some way of asserting what it wants us to interpret it as. So if I'm not mired in sci-fi, perhaps the phenomena says, oh, maybe this is something that would appeal to them and that would help them explain this and not, help them fit it into their particular worldview. No, I'm not saying that there isn't an extraterrestrial component in the sense that we would know it. I'm just, I take umbrage often with the role that consciousness plays in a lot of these phenomena. And I always am skeptical of the phenomena because it has proven so deceptive time and again.
That is a big point right there, is that this phenomena, and it doesn't matter if you're looking at channeled material, whether you're looking at the UFO experience or what you're looking at, it tends to have that trickster. It messes with you. It tells you things that are true, followed by things that are not true. Kiel's work on the Mothman prophecies is a great example where so many of these prophecies that were given came true, but then the one with the bridge collapse was not of the bridge collapse. I forget what the prophecy actually was, but it came about completely differently. And did they know? Was it a trick to mess with us, or did somehow they read something wrong? I think Andrew Collins had a very interesting book with, I think it's called Light Quest. And he talks about the UFO phenomena being explained as plasma entities, intelligent plasma entities. And when we get close enough, a sort of temporary bubble universe gets formed where we kind of like can communicate and things can interact with us in ways that they can't in our reality or their reality. And these things only exist while we're close to these plasma energies. And there's a decent amount of evidence suggesting that plasma has something to do with the UFO phenomena. How much of it is hard to say because, it's still kind of in its infancy. But people like Paul Devereaux showed that so many UFO encounters happen along fault lines. Well, why would that be if they were space aliens coming down from space? However, when you look at the phenomena of earthquake lights, which are similar to things like the Marfa lights, these are plasma. So there could be some interaction there, and then you could take it to, the work of Persinger there with the God helmet and the way the electromagnetic fields can affect us, and think, well, if these if these fault lines are creating these plasmas, maybe there's also something that's affecting our view of reality and altering our consciousness at the same time, and then that plasma kind of just folds into the altered state of consciousness that we're having.
Really with the extraterrestrial hypothesis, the thing that always gets me is we're relying on these entities, if that's what they are, self-reporting. It's not like we see a port of call on the back of their spaceship that says, honk if you're from Zebul Ganubi. Yeah, you know, so, you know, hi, I'm from Zeta Reticuli, and also, you know, Josh Cutchin has never run a red light in his life. I mean, you know, it's one of those things like how much can we trust this sort of self-reporting that the phenomena claims to do?
Okay, well, let me throw this out, and then maybe I can just sit back and let you guys talk, because, you know, I hear what you're saying, but I also hear us mixing together the idea of consciousness, whatever that means, and others, and then spirits. And what's our best thinking on what we really know about the difference? Because, like, when you talk about the magic in the occult world, that's one thing that, you know, and I love Gordon White to death. I do have to push on some of that magic stuff, in that it seems to make a lot of assumptions about this spirit world, that if we were to really approach it from this scientific, for lack of a better term, we have no clue what's going on in that dimension, and how many dimensions there are, and what the hierarchy is, and all that stuff. And so then when we mix in the spirit world and the other world, and then this kind of blob of consciousness, I think it throws people. I know it throws me. What are we talking about?
Well, for me, having dealt with what seemed to be external entities through a good part of my life, I don't necessarily believe they're external. I don't know what to think of them. I don't know if all of this stuff comes from us and is projected outward, if we're somehow dealing with our own higher selves, or if there are indeed other entities out there that take the forms of things. I was actually listening to Josh's appearance on the Charm the Water podcast earlier tonight. And, you know, he was mentioning different demons and stuff and their attributes and stuff. And I'm thinking, okay, on a symbolic level, that's great, but not for a moment do I actually believe any of these things exist on a independent sort of world. Like, I don't think anyone's cataloged demons and these things are sitting around somewhere waiting for someone to summon them.
Well, why not? Why not? As above, so below. I mean,
Because it's almost too neat. It seems to fall into the human way of wanting to catalog and
box everything. Okay, but let's leave it really messy then. Let's leave it really messy. It's fuzzy, you know, to use the science word, the fuzzy boundaries of it. But let's say that, you know, there are some, you know, pretty bad people, psychopathic people that we encounter. And this is hypothetical. I'm sorry. I get excited. There's some really, really terrible deeds that are done, you know, whether it's Pizzagate or Franklin or, you know, pedophile, whatever that thing is, you know, there's some people that do really, really, and whether they did it or somebody else did it, that stuff happens. People do really, really terrible psychopathic things to even to people who totally can't defend themselves, like little yep. children. And we can all look at that and go, oh, that's horrible. So that exists. And then we have, so as above, so below, let's say that's reflected in the spirit world, that these spirits continue, because we look at the near-death experience research, we look at the after-death communication research. It seems mm-hmm. quite strong that people are connecting with family members, and as near as we can tell, there sometimes those family members are telling them stuff that they don't know, that they didn't expect. You know, it seems to be a real kind of interaction. So that would lead me to believe it's totally possible that there are spirit beings out there, and that they can be quite evil or malevolent, however we want sure. to kind of say it. But then, you know, there's all these other reports of this hierarchical kind of thing, where more of a demon, satanic kind of hierarchical thing. I don't know. But the data seems, I can totally understand how someone can get there with the...
Well, yeah.
I think where I'd have to fall on this is, even if there isn't some sort of... I mean, I disagree lightly with Soraya on this, because I think even if there isn't a hierarchy of of specifically named spirits, the fact that those have been important to mankind, the fact that that hierarchy has been important, the fact that these names have been important to mankind, means that it would be important to whatever would be interacting with us. Or conversely, if it's some sort of, you know, collective unconsciousness, it would be important to that too. It would be deeply ingrained in that. So I think it's sort of a moot point, because even if it isn't a literal interpretation, it's still affecting the way that whatever this is interacting with us. I would venture.
the main spirit that I have connected with. It gave me characteristics. It gave me information. It gave me symbols. I had no idea what it was trying to tell me until I looked up enough through mythology and came up with what it was. And I had never heard of it before. And I said, well, that's interesting. But I never actually believed it was the literal thing mm-hmm. as much as something taking that face.
Interesting.
If that makes sense.
Oh, totally makes sense. And I agree with what Josh was saying there, too. I mean, that's my working hypothesis is there is a co-creation thing going on. So totally to your point, and I have had this discussion on Skeptico, you know, because if you go back and really study the best we can, some of the ancient Hebrew and Christian, you know, Satan is like a total invention. I mean, he's just thrown in there, you know. So, but there's a reality, according to what you're saying, Josh, and I would totally agree with this. At this point, it's a reality because if enough people focus on that, and you're really saying the same thing, Sarai, you know, we can manifest that. And then we don't know the extent to which that becomes a reality, not just for us, but this kind of shared reality. I mean, I know this sounds really strange, but it also kind of fits with the data we have.
At one point, I would have said in 1,000 years, we're going to look at Lovecraft's work as factual. We're going to be looking at it like these entities were worshipped back 1,000 years ago. At this point, however, I'd almost say that's going to happen a lot sooner because there are already people who believe Lovecraft was tapping into something. And we know Lovecraft invented Cthulhu and these creatures, Yog-Sothoth and everything else. But who's to say he didn't tap into something, some kind of collective unconscious or some realm that, you know, he then interpreted these things into his fiction? And that may be what always happens. We can't understand these things for what they are because our brains are limited. And even though mind may not equal brain, the brain is what we have to use to interpret our reality. And it's a lot of this stuff may just be beyond the capability of our brain to actually faithfully interpret.
Yeah, no, I agree. I mean, if you've got a, you know, well, before the age when everything was HD, if you've got a, you know, 12-inch black and white tube television, you're not going to be able to see some of the detail in a film that was released, you know, last year. You know, it all comes down to the ability at which we can interpret these things. And if you aren't an adherent of this sort of, you know, narrow-minded brain, mind equals brain paradigm, if you really do subscribe to the non-locality of consciousness, you have to admit that there must be limiting factors on the way that we perceive these things.
One of the weirdest experiences I had was being up on the edge of this cliff, at the edge of this Potter's Field from a psychiatric institute where we used to hang out all the time. It overlooked Seneca Lake, absolutely beautiful location. And there were three of us standing there, and on the other side of the trees, which you couldn't see through, the entire tree starts shaking. And I thought it was like a deer rubbing its horns against the tree because there's a lot of deer around here and buck do, you know, push against the tree. Maybe it had, you know, young or something nearby and was warning us off. But the whole tree is moving, and my friend starts freaking out. What's causing the tree to move? Because, I mean, it was a decent-sized tree, and the whole thing was shaking. So I start walking down the path that goes kind of parallel to the field, and I get to the point where I can see the other side of the tree, and there's nothing there, and the tree stops. So he's like, well, what is it? And I'm like, there's nothing there, and it's a big open field. Nothing ran away. So I walk back, and again, the tree starts shaking. You can feel the ground shaking as if something is jumping up and down. That's what, another reason I thought it was like a deer or something, because you can feel the weight of the dunk, 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 as something was moving. And so he's freaking out some more. Well, it's moving again. And our other friend then says, what are you guys talking about? Hmm. And we both looked at him and went, what? The tree. The tree is moving. He's like, the tree is sitting perfectly still. What are you guys talking about? And at that moment, I thought, are you blocking this out? Or are we seeing two different things at this moment? Like, was this whole thing to show me that our perceptions are not what we think they are? And this was someone, the person who wasn't seeing it was someone who had experienced a lot of stuff with me. Mm-hmm. So it's not like he normally blocked things out. So why was he not able to see? And it was freaking him out because my other friend was obviously so freaked out about what he was seeing. So what does that tell us about our perception and what reality is? You know, was the tree moving? Was he blocking it out? Was he seeing a different reality than we were seeing? What was happening right then?
And if we reintroduce our friends, the others, the aliens, ET, whatever we want to call it, what if they are at a different level of being able to manipulate this reality kind of thing? And as you were alluding to, Joshua, you know, if there is a physical component, measurable component of it, which there is, you know, we can't get around that. What if they're able to manipulate it better? I mean, then all bets are off again, you know? I mean,
absolutely. I mean, there's a great quote that a friend of my father was being sworn in as president at a Presbyterian college. And one of the questions on the during the interview was, you know, how big is your God? And I felt that it was his response was one of the most insightful things. It's something so much more nuanced than I would ever say. But the response was, if I could tell you how big my God was, he wouldn't be my God. So I feel like yeah, it's like a movie script line or something. But
that's good, yeah.
I feel like, again, coming back to my criticism of the ETH, I feel like it's such a narrow way of us trying to understand some sort of thing that's going on, and I'm not sure that we're even capable of understanding it. And even if there is an extraterrestrial component, it could be so advanced that there is no need for a physical spaceship. But they know that whatever this extraterrestrial intelligence is aware that we wouldn't necessarily be able to conceptualize that. I'm still talking in terms that we can conceptualize. It might even be far stranger than that what they're able to do to visit. It's just why I have one of the main reasons that I have a trouble with that paradigm. But yeah, I mean, I really do think that once you start introducing things like psi phenomena, like the validity of the near-death experience, to, you know, these consciousness deniers, if you can call them that, then I think that it really blows open the lid for anything.
Okay, so then you introduced the G word, so I'm going to go with it. So we got the God thing, you know? And the trouble with it for me is that I think a lot of times we dance around that being what we really want to understand. You know, that's what we really want to know. Is God there? You know, is there God? Is there this higher thing? And what I always do in a lot of times is try and refine that down, because I get a lot of pushback from the atheist crowd and certainly from the materialistic atheist scientific crowd, total pushback. But there's a lot of pushback from the paranormal, spiritual, even the magical kind of folks have a lot of pushback on that. And what I do is try and tie into, so I'm going to bounce this off you, and you guys push back as hard as you can on this, because I that's how I learn and I grow. So I do not mind being pushed back on this. But I look at the near-death experience science stuff for two reasons. Number one, where I think the near-death experience science gets us is, and we do have the medical evidence to prove this, is the brain is out of the equation. So all those people who like the mind-brain stuff, they're really left on the sidelines on this, because near-death experience is not a brain-based phenomenon.
Right.
So then, but number two, where it takes us is, to me, the evidence is clear. You know, I just interviewed Dr. Jeff Long again, who I think has done really nice work on this. And, you know, the God thing comes up over and over again. And it comes up in a way that's really hard to dance around it. And the message is, there's a hierarchical order to this consciousness, and it leads somewhere. And it's kind of inescapable at that point, because you start talking about something that starts sounding like what everyone talks about when they talk about God. So, you know, what do we do with that data point?
To me, the most interesting thing about the near-death experience is the fact that people can report what's happening outside their body when their brain is not functioning, and they can do it to a near-perfect level. To me, that solidifies that there is something more to us than just the brain, because there's no way they can do it otherwise. And there's enough evidence there over the years accumulated to make that a pretty definite data point. However, what happens beyond that point, although there are similarities, there's also a lot of differences. And I've always like pushed away from channeled stuff. Most of the time I feel like a lot of the channeled things, even if they're somewhat genuine, don't seem to give you really anything other than like false platitudes and such. The only exception I have to that is Jane Roberts with Seth. And part of the reason is when I read Seth Speaks, one of the things that had bugged me about near-death experiences is that people will die and not have a near-death experience. And I would read other accounts where people didn't actually die, but they had a near-death experience. So Jane Roberts writing all this stuff before near-death experiences were a thing, really. I mean, before the first books on it came out, talking about the what happens when you die. And Seth is saying, well, some people stay in their body for a while. They don't leave their body right away. Others will leave their body as soon as the body starts dying. He's like, there is no strict point of death. Consciousness will sometimes leave earlier or later. And I'm thinking, well, that would explain some things right there. And then he went on to explain that some people have very set ideas of what they're going to encounter when they die. And that there are those on the other side that help those people make the transition by creating a reality for them that is what they expect to see. So I think when you look at some of the similarities, you can find out sort of what's really there. But, you know, one person meets Jesus, one person meets, you know, Muhammad, another person meets grandma. Is it really any of those things, or is it something else masquerading as those because deep down that's what you expect to see when you get there?
Well, but then again, to play the role of Alex, there are people
who see figures from other faiths that they, you know, were not expecting to see. It, again, it doesn't quite line up with that whole, you know, co-creative sort of thing.
But you also find, and correct me if I'm wrong here, Alex, but a lot of people who survive near-death experiences don't necessarily get more religious, but they get more spiritual.
Yeah, but that's kind of the points, right? And you know, so Dr. Jeff Long in his latest book, and I thought he just did a fantastic job, because this is the point, I think, for me that really resonates, and yet not enough people want to dig in there, is it's not about the narrative. What people report over and over again is that it's not about the narrative. It's not about seeing Jesus. It's not about all that stuff. The overwhelming experience people have is the experience of love.
Yes.
Right? This indescribable connection, this indescribable feeling of love. But there's also a morality component to it. It's inescapable. So if you add those two together, if you add the love component and you add the morality component, there is a right and there is a wrong, you're just now playing in the God playground. And I don't know what that means. I mean, I am not a religious person, and I don't have this fixed dogmatic understanding of what God is. But, you know, it's one of those pet peeves, like we're all kind of sharing some of our pet peeves. When I hear people talk about this fuzzy consciousness, spirit, it's like, there seems to be some order there, guys. That seems to be the evidence that's coming back, is there is an order, there is a morality, there is a structure, and that puts the big guy up on top of that.
There's also people who have negative near-death experiences, and they're not necessarily bad people. But you have those people who experience just being out in the middle of a void.
Sure.
And being very alone. And
sure, but it's not about the narrative. I mean,
that sense of love isn't there in those, is what I'm saying.
So I've talked to a bunch of different people that have explored that kind of thing. And one is, we don't know exactly what that process is, right? Mm-hmm. So we have to take the accounts one by one and kind of tear them apart. But the majority of those accounts that I've talked to people about who've actually researched them, invariably they resolve themselves in the way that, in a positive way, as kind of a lesson learned. You know, I was down there and then I saw the light and I came through it. And yeah, there are some that say I was just in that darkness, horrible place, and, you know, boom, then I was back, you know. So that's not always the case. But overwhelmingly, that is the case, that they're down there for a short period of time and then there's a speck of light and they move towards the light, or someone comes down and helps them move up. And it winds up resolving itself in a lot of the same way. So again, if we look past the narrative and kind of look at the overall message, the feeling, a lot of people are saying the same thing. So let's not get too hung up on the near-death experience, but we all think that it's an important data point in this whole thing, because if we then try and fit that back in, like you mentioned Kenneth Ring or occult experiences, you know, I mean, it's like all this stuff out there, that has to be one of the data points.
Sure. And I don't think we can possibly conceive of what God is. I mean, we can't even conceive of the size of the universe, much less what is beyond it. You know, you look at those pictures from deep space with all those galaxies and you think, oh, you know, they look real small. But when you realize that we're the tiniest little fraction in one of those galaxies, I don't think that we can conceive of something so far beyond our own universe when we can't even conceive of our own universe. We can't even conceive of the size of something like the sun, really, because all we know is the distances we've traveled, which is not very far by universal standards. When you get to that whole God thing, I think that God, I mean, we may be God trying to understand itself. I've always liked that idea. It could be that we're going back to that pool of water that we dripped away from, and that's that feeling of love. It could be that we are completely independent from that, but we're once a part of it, and it's like going home. And it could be that consciousness itself is God, that everything that is, the all that is, if you will, everything is a part of whatever God really is. And maybe God is just a small part of something else.
Yeah, I mean, as a practicing Christian with a lot of cognitive dissonance, I have to give you a slow clap on that, Sarai. I mean, I think everything that you said is they're all completely valid interpretations. I really do.
I mean, we don't know. I'm pretty sure God's not sitting on a cloud with a long white beard on a throne.
What about the morality component? That's a stumbling block for a lot of folks. It enters in, you know, certainly in the spirit magic kind of stuff, but it even enters in into the UFO stuff, you know, is what they're doing wrong? Are they evil? You know, abduction is a great one. I did a series of interviews with David Jacobs and Mary Rodwell. David Jacobs is the, you know, these are not our friends. These are evil, evil. He doesn't say evil because he's in atheistic kind of humanist kind of guy, right? But that's where he's going. And then you talk about Mary Rodwell, and she's going, a lot of people are having spiritually transformative experiences through their abductions, and that's what's really at the core of this experience. What do we make of the morality of the paranormal?
I think some of that comes, I safely would say some of that comes into how you approach the phenomena. If you approach it and you're scared of it, your experience is going to be negative. Not unlike, for instance, doing psychedelics or something. If you go in with a lot of fear and trepidation, you're not necessarily going to have a good trip. And there may be a connection there as well. But I don't know, you know, when you look at things like that, when you look at things like morality and such, I mean, you know, a kitten playing with a ball of string is all cute, and that's a really good thing. But when you think about it, that kitten's learning to hunt and kill other animals right there.
Yeah. But come on, we always say that. Is there evil? Is there bad? Is there right and wrong? Is there good and
You mean like in an empirical sense outside of us? Because obviously there's right and wrong and evil to us from our individual points of view. But I don't know if there's an absolute to that.
Ah, come on. Commit one way or another. So the Pizzagate, everyone hates Pizzagate now. I think it's fascinating. I think it's incredibly important. I think it's underreported, if anything. But forget Pizzagate. Talk about the Franklin Affair, because it's easier, because it's 20 years ago and it's a bunch of Republicans did it, you know, where they're abducting these little kids into sex trade, these innocents, you know, unless you want to kind of overlay some kind of reincarnation, a gradient. However, most of us sit there and go, there's no way to resolve that in a way that says, well, you know, it's
Absolutely. It's totally evil from our standpoint. It is a horrible act that nobody should do.
But from what standpoint is it not evil?
From a universal standpoint, it's a little blip that may never matter one way or the other.
But it's an evil blip. It can still be a blip and be an evil blip.
Well, that's
see,
true.
But, no, no, see.
But okay, so look. Sorry, Josh. Let me just throw this last thing.
That's good. That's good.
Going to the way that Seth would look at things. Not that I want to keep bringing Seth up, but he suggests that people incarnate knowing what they're doing, and that some people need to learn to experience certain things, including bad things, in order to progress further in their incarnations and in their existence. So it may be evil from a perspective, from a higher perspective. It may be saying that needed to happen to understand things better, to learn better, to move forward in some way. Even if it doesn't affect that person directly, it may have affected someone else.
Yeah, that's exactly the same thing that I was going to say, Sarai, in a different sort of way. My wife and I we got our first dog this past Friday, it occurs to me that, you know, from her standpoint, you know, it's awful us taking her to the vet, and the things that she has done to her at the vet are horrifying, and it must seem like a complete betrayal, you know. But it really does serve a higher purpose that she has no way of conceptualizing that we're actually doing this for her own good, and she just can't wrap her, you know, her canine brain around it. And sometimes I wonder if things like the alien abduction phenomena aren't serving a similar purpose by some sort of higher intelligence, be it spiritual, be it, you know, extraterrestrial perhaps. Maybe this is for our own good. I don't think there's any way of objectively making that call.
And the extraterrestrial, you know, or whatever the abduction scenario is, could be us on some level.
Okay, let me pound on this one more time. Okay, have you guys ever heard of Rich Martini? He did this. He's big time. Yeah, you know, he's a Hollywood guy, but he really got into the past life stuff. He did this book called Flipside, and he made a film called Flipside. He did the past life and the life in between lives thing, and he got some really interest, no matter what you think about that. And I tend to think there's definitely something there. But like, here's the point. He says, I experienced through these sessions people who went back and were in Nazi concentration camps. And he said the real sufferers were the guards, because the guards took on that act that they did, and that became a part of their consciousness that they couldn't resolve, right? So now he's saying, okay, along the lines of what you guys are saying, I think take it in a different, in a little bit. So take it in a multi-life perspective, right?
Right.
I'm going to live multiple lives. I'm going to have different experiences. Those experiences are going to resolve themselves. You don't want to be that Nazi guard. You're taking on a lot of stuff. You know what I mean? And if you believe the near-death experience science, that's what they're telling you, right? This is like, you can't, like, say this is absolute truth, but you hear it over and over again, you start to think there's some validity to it, is that you are going to experience everything that you did from the perspective of the people you did it to. So now, how does that look? And
doesn't that define hell for somebody like Hitler?
It defines hell for all of us, not just Hitler, because I've done enough. If I think of that through that lens, I can think of all the shitty things that I've done, you know, just.
Yeah, but not to that level. Not to that level, though.
Well, yeah, but none of us are too, you know, we're all at our own level. But the point I think that I would pull back on that is to say, but that's still evil. That's still, objectively, we can chalk it up on one side and say, that's naughty or nice. That goes on the naughty side. You know, this goes on the nice side. And I just, I got to push that, because I think we shy away from that. And I especially hear that in the occult and the magic world, in this kind of, you know, we can't say, you know, it's all, well, no, I think we can.
I think, too, you got to realize that most people think they're the good guys, including the Nazis. The Nazis thought the Jews were the problem, and that's why they were exterminating them. They thought they were doing the world a favor. They were the good guys doing this. And whereas some of them probably realized that wasn't the case, there were some of the people involved in that who honestly thought they were the good guys. They weren't the evil ones. And if they had won, if that ideology had somehow taken over the world, we may look at that very differently nowadays.
Yeah, and I think the reason that we can objectively say something like Nazi Germany was evil is because it was people doing it to people.
Yeah.
You know, if it had been an outbreak of rabid wolves hunting down Jews, it wouldn't have had this objective black and white evil sort of thing. And you know, it's because it's just what's happening in nature. Of course, I don't know why rabid wolves would hunt down Jews anyway. But
in their genetics is drawing the wolves to them, and we have to figure out genetically what it is.
That doesn't seem objectively evil. Similarly, like I suppose that if you are, it sort of has to be a somewhat level playing field to make that sort of call of objective evil. And if it's, you know, if it's little green scientists coming down in spacecraft and doing things non-consensually, then yeah, it's evil. But if there is some sort of higher purpose that we can't even conceptualize for why things like possibly alien abduction occur, if it is a materialist sort of thing, then I think it's a lot harder to make that call, because we just literally might not understand its purpose or might not be able to comprehend its purpose.
You know, the other thing when we deal with the concept of reincarnation is that you look at the abortion debate. Is it, are you killing a baby? Are you killing a consciousness? Well, if the consciousness can't die and it's just going to incarnate in another baby somewhere along the line, does it matter? You know, I mean, if you're saving a child from being raised in a family who doesn't want it, and you know, like if we could prove reincarnation, and you know, it's not, you know, the soul of that child isn't going to hell. It's not going to cease to exist. It's just going to move on to something else. I think that would change the way the whole conversation goes. And again, this is something that you can argue, you know, some people will argue that abortion is evil. You're killing a baby. But if there's reincarnation, if we can prove there's reincarnation, if we know that's a fact, then are you really killing anything? And does anything really die?
No, I was just going to say, it's interesting with that sort of idea that if it were a spiritual outlook, we wouldn't view something as that as evil, when it tends to be the more spiritual or the more, you know, religious affiliated people who view that as evil. It's sort of an interesting flip around of what you said, Soraya. So I get what you're saying, but that doesn't necessarily bear itself out in terms of what we understand, you know, or in terms of the way that people react in the current climate.
Well, that's because reincarnation isn't an established fact. I'm saying if things change where we could establish reincarnation, right, this is what happens. Most of the people against abortion are usually religious people who do not believe in reincarnation.
Yeah, I don't think that reincarnation is the fulcrum point on that issue. And I would bring it back though, because to me it seems like the same thing, where we're kind of skating around the morality issue, even if it's a personal morality, which we all can easily come to and say, yeah, sure, I have a personal morality. But it does seem to me that we have to come to grips with the fact that there does seem to be this collective morality, and it's reflected in the spirit world over and over again. And it kind of comes through in the paranormal. You know, I was mentioning the thing with the abduction, and maybe we can kind of start wrapping it up. This has been really, really great conversation. But I was really interested in talking to Jacobs and Mary Rodwell. And I spoke to each of them a couple times, kind of pinging them back and forth, you know, and kind of a threaded debate, if you will. And I ended it with Jacobs, and he said, look, you know, this is a program. This is a program. That was one of his main things. And it's not nice. You know, so there's an intentional kind of, you know what I mean when I say it's a program? This is that's what he called it, a program. But do you understand what I mean when I say it's a program?
Yeah.
I mean, this is like an orchestrated, a plan. We have a goal. We have something that we're doing, you know. And he said, all the people who are doing abduction research and are doing regression work with these people, they're all finding the same thing. And I was like all excited. Ooh, I know that's not true. I know Mary won't agree with that, you know? So I go talk to Mary, and she goes, well, you know, I may not agree with some of his conclusions, but yeah, that's what I find that too. I do find there's that element to it. And I was like, oh shit, you know, that's not what I, that's not what I wanted to hear. And that's not what I expected to hear. Well, so what do you guys make of the abduction thing? And what do you make of the morality of it? Because at some level, you know, even if like one of Mary Rodwell's points is that these people consented before they were born kind of thing. I don't know about you, but I don't want anyone telling me that they're doing something to me and, oh, I consented in a fast life. That doesn't mean a whole lot to me.
I think I find that the abduction scenario is probably very much like shamanic awakenings. I really do think there is a similarity there. You find a lot of similar points. And then you find it in other things as well, you know, going back as Joshua can attest to the fairy faith and so on and so forth. But I really think that is a strong connection, and that part of what this phenomenon does is wake people up. So some people, it doesn't work. You know, they have this experience. It's traumatic for them. They never get over it. But then you look at someone like Whitley Strieber. It was traumatic for him. But over time, he grew as a person in ways he probably never would have without that experience. He seems to be a very spiritual person, which probably would not have been the case without this experience. Just like a near-death experience, I don't think most people come back from near-death experiences going, that was totally what I wanted to happen. You know,
so Raya, let me ask you this straight up. Do you think any of the reported abduction experiences are genuine accounts? I'm not genuine, it's not, take genuine out of it. Are accounts of people encountering extraterrestrial beings?
Not in a nuts and bolts variety. The actual source could be extraterrestrial, but not in the sense of them flying a spaceship down here and taking someone up into it from another planet.
And I want to get Joshua on this, but why do you draw the line there? So you're saying... That's a strange place to draw the line, to saying, yeah, it could be ET, but not in a spaceship. I mean, why not?
Because the evidence doesn't bear it out. What you have is circumstantial evidence that suggests a spaceship, but then you look at other things. When, like I said, look at shamanic journeys. You look at the experiences I've had, for instance. I didn't see a UFO till far after I had experiences, and I never had an abduction encounter. These things tie together on – and you see the patterns flow through them. In Josh's first book, I love the fact that there are some stories you start reading and you go, I don't know if this is a UFO encounter or a fairy encounter.
Mm-hmm.
Because this stuff blends together so seamlessly. So I draw the line at nuts and bolts extraterrestrial simply because I don't see the evidence for it. If you focus only on certain things, like David Jacobs does, you can see the evidence for it. But when you take it as a whole, it doesn't make sense as a nuts and bolts spacecraft coming down.
So
I'm also saying I don't know where the source is. I'm just saying that the evidence doesn't 100% support a nuts and bolts thing, and I don't think a lot of it supports it at all.
Yeah, I mean, I think if you look at just the simple logic of, in terms of the most common entities that people see being, you know, bipedal, two eyes, a mouth, you know, a nose. If you look at these things, just from a scientific standpoint, that tends to be enough to make it personally discredit the ETH in my mind, the extraterrestrial hypothesis. But having said that, you know, I'd like to echo the sentiment of somebody that I've grown to admire quite a bit, Gordon White, where he talks about the ancient alien theory, and he says, you know, I'm not opposed to it, and I'm not even, you know, saying that something like that didn't happen in the past at some point. It just doesn't seem like, you know, the hypothesis that he wants to go with. I think similar to the alien abduction thing, like, I don't think it explains the lion's share of what goes on. I'm not averse to an extraterrestrial visitation abduction sort of scenario having happened at some point, or having happened even in, you know, over the course of several years. But if you look at the way that a lot of these things tend to mesh with aspects of reality that, you know,
odd synchronicities, all these sort of things that really tend to press the idea of what we know in terms of our materialist interpretation of the universe, that pushes me out of the ETH camp solidly. Now, again, having said that, I don't think that there's a one size fits all answer for this. I think that a certain portion might be extraterrestrial. I think a certain portion is shamanic awakening. You know, I'm a big fan of fairy folklore, so I'm leaving that door open in some sense, whatever that means. And you know, I think that there also could be a very deliberate, governmental or, you know, control system, you know, human beings on human being inflicted.
You know, you kind of cut out there just a little bit, but I have to agree with you. No, that's okay. As I say, I have to kind of agree with you. To me, the only thing that makes sense is a combination of a lot of different things. Because, you know, one of the interesting things in talking to Jacobs, who, you know, I'm surprised he talked to me a second time because he really didn't like, because I was really pushing him on the, because he's a humanist, an atheist. I just think that's just such a blockheaded, I just don't know how you get to that. Like we were saying, like, you know, Joshua, you were saying, you know, people who just won't accept the psi phenomenon. It's like, they did it as carefully as we could possibly do it. As a matter of fact, they did it. It's better than 90% of the science that's out there, you know, because they use the best controls. How can you sidestep that? But I digress, because his methodology is pretty compelling. I mean, because he'll talk to you, you know, he'll kind of lecture you about his methodology for doing these regressions and how he intentionally tries to mislead people. He'll say, okay, now I know you said that the craft was round and that this was that. And it's like, no, the craft isn't round, you know, and that the floor is smooth and it doesn't, you know, he'll give them false information to see if he'll correct them, because he's found that it's a very tricky process in this regression thing, and that you can conflate things even if you don't want to. So he's an interesting guy, and what's come out of that is hard for me to completely sidestep. I accept with what both you guys are saying that there are other cases and accounts that just don't fit, you know, but some of them, boy, I don't know.
Well, if you only look at some of the data, then you have a very, you know, limited view of what's going on. And that's kind of what Bud Hopkins did when I started reading Hopkins stuff. I mean, he makes a very convincing case to support his point. And it wasn't until I started seeing the cases that didn't support his point that I started going, oh, wait a minute. Now his case doesn't seem so airtight. I mean, Jacobs makes, if you only look at Jacobs' information, it makes a very solid point. But when you look at all the stuff that's going on, if you open up your mind and look at it all as a vast field, you realize it's a small little niche that only looks that way because he's orienting it that way. And I would totally be willing to accept an extraterrestrial explanation if the evidence started pointing that way. If new stuff started coming out and it looked like, oh, maybe this is an extraterrestrial thing, I would totally go with that. I don't want to believe one thing over another. This is just how my own experiences and the research I've done has led.
Well, Joshua. And you know, for me, yeah, you know, I was just going to add to that is someone like I run into problems with some research that, you know, is alleging some sort of hybrid hypothesis of alien abduction, because there's so little language in there that says it seems as though some people claim there's not a lot of wiggle room for that. The only things that I can say personally for certain about the alien abduction phenomena specifically is that no one for sure is 100% right on it. That's something I firmly believe. And the other thing that I can say is that a huge part of it has got to be misunderstood. We have not wrapped our heads around it. I'm convinced of that, because there's no one size fits all answer to any of this.
I also want to say, I believe that people have had these experiences. In no way will I ever tell someone, I don't believe your experience. I mean, unless there's, you know, red flags shooting up left and right, I err on the side of, most people are probably honest about what they think they experience, whether they label it or not. I may not agree with the labels they put on it, but I fully believe that people experience these things and believe what they experienced.
Yeah, I'm so glad. I think that I
can
think
you start that over. Can you start that over, Josh? Can you start
sure,
over on
sure.
that?
I was just gonna, yeah, absolutely. I'm so glad that you mentioned that, Soraya, because I think that in you know, the paranormal field in general, I think that we vastly overestimate how many hoaxes there are. I mean, yes, obviously there are. You go to YouTube, you can find, you know, scores of them. But that's sure. a small drop in the pond compared to the people who claim to have had certain experiences. Now, whether or not those are objectively true in terms of the way they interpreted them is another thing. You know, a lot of it's probably misidentification. A lot of it might be something along the lines of mental illness or something. But, like, I do believe that outright deliberate fabrication is a lot less prevalent than a lot of, you know, skeptics would like to believe in this field.
I think that's a great point. I don't think that can be overemphasized enough, because that just seems to be confirmed over and over again by, you know, these strange accounts. And then the more you press them, and then you find other people that have really similar accounts, and then they start looking like everything you'd want in a good account. And, you know, the other thing, I guess, about the abduction thing, and then I'll let it go, is that the other thing that kind of rubs me, gets me, is when people start adding these very kind of common sense sounding materialistic explanations. Well, why would they do that? You know, why would alien beings from an advanced civilization want to draw blood from somebody? Surely they can. It's like, yeah, okay, but we have no clue. We don't know. We can only work bottom up from the data that we have, and the data that we have are these accounts. And then when we start getting accounts that are corroborated by other people, yeah, I saw this other person on the craft, you know, we were abducted together, and I never knew that person. And then I met him later, and I said, hey, you know, what about me? I said, I never told this to anyone, but yeah, you know, I mean, this is the kind of stuff. Then you say, okay, now we have to take that account, and yeah, we can't understand, you know, why they want to draw blood or why they want to mutilate cows or whatever they're doing. You know?
and with cattle mutilation, that's another one where you look at, there's a good case for government involvement in cattle mutilation. But then there's the cattle mutilations that make absolutely no sense to reality as we know it. One of my favorites is the one from the Skinwalker Ranch, where they were just a few feet away from the calf and they turned around and the thing was mutilated. And it's like, okay, well, obviously that wasn't the government conducting any tests, but at the same time, there's evidence that that some military entity is doing at least some of these. So is the phenomena copying something our government's doing in secret, or is the government using the phenomena as a cover for doing its own research?
Excellent example.
Okay, guys, this has been great. We will definitely have to do it again. But before I let you go, tell me a little bit about what's going on in your life, where you're going with Where Did the Road Go, Soraya? Josh, anything you have going on? I'm sure you have another book going out. You're good at cranking those things out, and you do a good job. You're a good writer. I know a good writer like that, man. You just can't. You're never going to be able to let it go.
It's like a drug.
here's the most shocking thing I learned about Josh. Are you ready? He's only been researching this stuff for a few years.
No, that's not. He says that. He says that, Soraya. just to make us feel bad. Just to make us slowpokes feel really, really bad.
No, in all seriousness, you know, I've had a lifelong interest in this, but I didn't really, you know, dig my teeth into podcasts and such. 20, so I just sort of was listening to that stuff, you know, day in and day out, and it just, you know, got under the skin. It got subcutaneous.
As far as Where Did the Road Go, that's you can find every show I've ever done, including ones with Alex, at wheredidtheroadgo.com. It's all free on there. We're on YouTube. We're on iTunes. We're all over the place. And I'm going to be expanding it a little bit later in the month as we come up on our fourth anniversary. I have a couple neat things I'm going to be announcing soon. And I mean, I try to deal with a lot of different stuff. Lost history. I really love, when I first started the show, I had a lot of shows on lost civilizations and stuff. And the three people I really wanted to get on right off the bat were Graham Hancock, Robert Schock, and Andrew Collins. And I got two of them. I've never asked Graham Hancock on. I wanted the show to be a little bigger before I dealt with Graham. I was really glad that Andrew Collins and Robert Schock had both come on a few times because I love that type of stuff. The what happened in the distant past. I mean, we've done shows on the Electric Universe. We've done shows on consciousness. We've done shows on missing people. I just did one on the Dyatlov Pass mystery. You know, obviously Bigfoot and other paranormal stuff. I've had various ghost hunters on. You know, it literally goes wherever I feel like taking it.
And you do a good job with a lot of that. Well, you do a good job on a lot of that different material, which I mean that in a very complimentary way, because a lot of people do a lot of different, cover a lot of different topics, but, you know, can't really dive into them at the depth that you do. You seem to have a real grasp on a lot of different things, which is admirable.
I also always try to read the people's books who are coming on. It's not always possible, but 99% of the time I've read the book right before they came on.
Well, that is hard. I wish I could have that percentage of track record. I like podcasting. If they've done interviews, I'll listen to all their interviews. But, man, I have a hard time finding the time to read all those books. I got to admit it.
I have done that a few times where I just – there's no way. You know, it's a 600-page book, and I go, okay, there's no way I'm going to read this anytime soon. You're going to have to give me questions, and I'll go check out a few other shows you've done.
I hate getting – I never ask people for questions. I never want people – to give me questions in advance, because I don't know, sometimes those interviews go well too when you haven't drank all the Kool-Aid, you know.
Yeah,
so you really don't, you know, you, because it's hard to get on the other side. When somebody is a good writer and a good thinker, they can put together a case and it sounds very compelling, and you get on the other side of it, you know, a few months later, and you're like, oh dang, I wish I would have, you know, ask the questions. And sometimes you can get there by not going all the way in and just asking the more obvious questions. But now we're doing podcast techie talk, inside baseball stuff.
And I have been working on a book. I've been working on a book since for the last 4 years, actually. And I kind of stalled out a little bit on it for a while. And Steph Young kind of gave me a kick in the ass about getting working on it more, so I started working on it more. Josh has read some of it and has been helping out do some proofreading, but it's probably, I don't know, a seventh of the way done, an eighth of the way done. I'm just kind of starting the first four chapters, I think I have. And it's just, it's gonna cover my experiences. It's gonna go into detail about why I think the way I do, try to give people some of my worldview and why I think the way I do and why I look at some of this phenomena the way I do.
Fantastic. I will definitely look forward to hearing that. And Josh, are you planning on staying active in Where Did the Road Go? You've had some great runs on there in terms of co-hosting and doing some of these roundtables with Soraya. Is that something you plan on doing in the future?
As long as he'll have me. you know, one of the things that I've said on the record a lot is, you know, and I'll say it again, like, if Soraya decides to never have another show with me, you know, in the future, I'm still going to listen to Where Did the Road Go, because I really am, you know, I was a fan before I became involved in Where Did the Road Go, and I think it's I think it's one of the – Soraya does a really level-headed job. So this is the shower praises on Soraya hour.
And the funny thing is I had heard Josh on Micah Hank's program, Grelian Report, and long before he published the first book, just talking about the food and fairy faith. And I thought to myself, when this guy puts a book out, I want him on my show. And then he put the book out and contacted me and said, can I come on the show? And I'm like, why, yes, you can.
Fantastic. Yep. When that works out like that, doesn't it?
It's synergy, right?
Yeah. Well, I'll tell you what, it's been absolutely great having both of you on. And like I say, we'll have to do it again. You guys are the king of the round tables. And I'm going to do more of these too. I think they're fun. And I'm so glad you were the inaugural event for a Skeptical round table. Really exciting to have both of you on. Thanks.
Anytime, Alex. And thanks for inviting me.
Yeah, an absolute pleasure.
All right, and that'll do it.
All right, sorry, go ahead.
Did that live up to your expectations?
Yes, and more. Great, man. Great, great. I hope I can put it out to people in a way that in a way that they want to hear. You know, a lot of times my audience doesn't like when I go off of the sciencey stuff. So I gotta go where I want to go. Yeah, you can't. Yeah, remember totally...
What'd you say, Josh? Yeah,
I was just gonna say. I think it was the you interviewed Mike Clellan too, right?
Yes.
Yeah, oh, I think it was. I think it was after Mike's interview that you got some pushback, right? Some pretty hard pushback after Mike's interview.
Oh,
I think.
Oh, yeah, I get pushback. I get pushback all the time.
You never get pushback.
I don't get a lot of pushback. When I had the people on who were doing the hybrid stuff, I got a little pushback of people going, "This doesn't seem like the type of guest you'd have on. These people don't seem as credible as the people you normally talk to." And I'm thinking, yeah, it's because I was kind of fooled into putting them on the air. that was the woman who believed she was an actual hybrid. And I look at it and I go, I believe she believes that, and I believe something happened to her, but I believe the interpretation of what happened to her is probably completely different.
I thought that was a really interesting show. I liked it.
Yeah, some people really liked it, but that's the one I got the most negative emails about, where people were like, I don't think these people are on the level. I don't think that, you know, and it's just, I think I have a very grounded audience. And when I presented that, they were like, what's happening here?
Well, grounded in what way, though? You know, that's so strange. Like you have an audience that's grounded in your stuff. And then when they go out in the real world, people go, what are you talking about? That's totally ridiculous. And I have the same thing. So I have people who, because I started with the very science show and Rupert Sheldrick and Dean Radin, who are fantastic. And I love those guys, but you know, they're grounded in that. And that's all they want to hear. More sci stuff, more parapsychology stuff, more near death experience stuff. Well, and I'm like, but wait a minute, that got us to the point of like what we're talking about, just saying all bets are off. You know, all bets are off on that. So why do we want to go down the science path? Because you feel comfortable with that. You want to hear more science stuff because that's what makes you feel comfortable. But we've just gotten to the point where we've said we can't rely on that. That's just the jumping off point into this big unexplored territory, and they don't want to jump, you know?
So to me, grounded is people not jumping to conclusions. Like with that interview, it was interesting for what it was, but they were jumping to the conclusions of this is what we know. This is what happened. You know, there's no playroom here. This is absolute to us. Again, the same reason I wouldn't have Stanton Friedman on, because not that he's not a grounded researcher in like facts, but that he's absolutely sure he has the answers to it. You know, I'm grounded in the, we don't actually know what's happening. Let's look at what we actually do know and then speculate out from there.
Yeah, I mean, like, thanks for ruining my chances to ever talk to Stanton Friedman.
Hey, if you want to interview him, you are welcome to, and I'll put it on the show.
No. Again, like, if you've heard one interview with him, you've heard them all. I think the most interesting interview he's done in forever was with Rogan and Lobo on Project Archivist, because they made him talk about other stuff, and it was kind of funny because he kept on trying to steer it back to his usual talking points. But yeah, for me, it's just that, I mean, like, I feel like I talked a pretty good game, but like, I don't know what to make of any of this shit. You know, I do know what I don't make of it, if that makes any sense. You know, I do know what things I do know what things people feel very secure about that don't answer, you know, a third of the data points. That's what I can say, and that's about where I draw the line.
Well, it's like the missing people stuff. I mean, that's one of the biggest shows we've done. The different, you know, whether it be David Politis or Steph Young or whatever, and you get people who are just absolutely certain they have the answers, and it's like, your answer doesn't make sense. And I like the kind of open, when I say grounded, I mean kind of open-minded, but based, grounded in facts, you know, what facts we can actually pull from this stuff, or at least what look like facts that we can pull out of this stuff, and commonalities.
Grounded methodologically, right? I mean, grounded methodologically, like I have a way of processing, you know, problem solving, and I get you.
Yeah. You know, but some people are just so stuck. Like, there are people who think everything is Bigfoot. It doesn't matter what it is. It's Bigfoot. And it's like, oh, dear God.
Yeah, exactly.
That story I told of this tree shaking. Someone wrote me and went, that was an invisible Bigfoot. And I went, of course it was.
Jesus. Now, I would say that perhaps it's it's a similar thing that people mistake for Bigfoot sometimes. You know, one of the things, one of the things, Alex, that I've been, one of the points that I've been pushing for a while is this idea that if you look at a lot of things that people attribute to Bigfoot in the woods, a lot of it is basically like poltergeist activity. It's the tossing of warm rocks and disembodied voices and, you know, all this sort of thing. So I could say that about your experience, Soraya, but that it was an invisible Bigfoot, I wouldn't ever say that.
Especially not with certainty, you know?
Yeah.
No, but Josh, you have a really nuanced kind of way of kind of knitting together, and not knitting together, that's not the right term, but of kind of trying to cover that data that I think is really, you know, open somebody up. You just start thinking, wow, yeah, you know, there are those similarities, but the guy doesn't want to put them in one pile or another. Wow, you know, I'm really intrigued. You know, that's great. Great stuff.
I appreciate it. I'm going to need all the help I can get because my next book is going to be on changelings and paranormal child abduction, which is going to put me – it's going to put me knee-deep in all this hybrid shit, and it's something that I've – it's something that I really don't care about, because so much of it is so, I feel like it's ill documented and it's a bit fanciful, but I'm going to wade into those waters and I'm going to see, you know, what little gems I could pull out that maybe really do resonate. Maybe there's something there. You know, I think I've already started to find some data points that correlate with fairy abduction that I don't think some people have mentioned before. So I'm already excited, but at the same time, like, it's a huge data set and it's definitely a different sort of approach than what I've done before. But we'll see what happens. You know,
I thought I heard on another show you said you were going to do a third book on like one of the other senses. I don't know what it was. It was like.
I've kicked around a couple of things. This one has been like, I feel like right after finishing the first one, I knew I was going to do something on smells. But this one's been, I've been kicking around a couple of ideas, and I had kicked around, a paranormal sound.
Oh right.
You know, I kind of got tired of that, you know.
Survey. I know, but man, I mean, from a book selling standpoint, you got to know that's the.
I might come back to it. But, you know, just in terms of writing, like every time I started thinking about, you know, gathering, you know, another survey and analysis, it sort of exhausted me. So this is going to be kind of a more chronologically structured thing that shows, you know, the, you know, child abduction in fairy folk, in fairy folklore and, you know, continuing on through, to the modern era and sort of, you know, saying, well, you know, look at this, you know, the obvious things that people have pointed out, but also, you know, the less obvious things, like, for example, it was very common in fairy folklore for, midwives to be abducted to the fairyland to care for, you know, the fairy children or to help one of the fairy women to birth. Well, if you look at some hybrid literature, there are plenty of people who have said that they've been taken by the aliens to, you know, go, show these hybrid children how to love and to teach them how to interact with people. So it's another one of those things that, I guess at the end of the day, it's just sort of what we were getting at when we were talking on the record. I don't know what I want people to realize is not that maybe it's not aliens. I want them to realize that a lot of this is the same thing. Like a lot of this is should be seen through a continuum. So that's what I really hope happens. I don't know if I'm getting anywhere, but.
Well, definitely let me know. Give me a shot at having you on Skeptica when you do that next book. Love to. I missed the first two. I missed the.
No worries. I'd love to, Alex. Thanks for the invite.
And he's still promoting the newest one,
Brimstone.
I loved having
the chance to have you on. I mean, man, that you've done some great interviews on it. I don't know what I could, you know, what I could add to it.
Yeah, the blood has been been squeezed from the stone a bit at this point. I'm still doing some more. I'm talking to Greg Carlwood tomorrow and.
Excellent.
But he's got a cool way of looking at things, and if nothing else, his delivery will be enjoyable. So
yeah, no, he's great. Okay, well, guys, thanks again. It was so much fun, and I'll definitely, you know, ping you when we get it out.
All right. Awesome.
Sounds great. Thanks so much, Alex. Really appreciate it.
Thanks again to Soraya and Joshua for joining me today on Skeptico. Let me tee up one question from this discussion, and that is, has the term consciousness been misappropriated or misused by the paranormal community in general? So we talked a little bit about this in the show, but if you go into the UFO community, there's a lot of talk about consciousness. If you go into the paranormal community, hauntings, ghosts, whatever, there's a lot of talk about consciousness, but not everyone always means the same thing. So there's one question I've teed up here, but you can kind of meld it into any question you want on that general area of, do we need some more grounding in what we're talking about when we talk about consciousness? Or is that grounding even possible because we don't know what consciousness is? So anyways, those are all questions we might talk about. The place to do it, of course, is through the Skeptico website at skeptiko.com, where you can download any of these shows for free. There's over 300 and, I don't know, 30 of them by now. You're welcome to all of them. You're welcome to share them with anyone you like. You're welcome to chop them up and repost them on YouTube, which some people do. All that stuff is allowed. Once it's out there, it's a free-for-all, so please take advantage of that. And while you're at the Skeptico site, what you might want to do is pop on over to the forum. There'll be a good discussion going on about this show. And I have to say, you know, a couple episodes ago, we did a show with David Matheson on Starmiss, and he was nice enough to join us in the forum, which happens somewhat frequently with Skeptico guests. And invariably, when those folks come over to the Skeptico forum, they always go, wow, this is really a great forum. And what makes it a great forum, of course, is you. I mean, we have a quality of listener on Skeptico and a quality of person who contributes on the forum that is really at a different level than you'll find in a lot of other places. So come be a part of that, read the post, but join in. It might feel a little uncomfortable at the beginning, but after a while, you'll get the hang of it. And it's really kind of, I think, a great way to kick around these ideas and grow and learn. So I again invite you to the Skeptico Forum if you haven't been. Well, that's going to do it for this episode. I have a couple of really interesting episodes coming up. Some interesting controversies that we're exploring. I do hope you stay with me for all of that. Until next time, do take care and bye for now.